Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Is hair a material?
Are biscuits a material?
Are crystals a material?
Is plastic a material?
Is porridge a material?
Can gases be a material?
Are eggs a material?
Is water a material?
What do you call everything that isn't a material?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at your question.
And yet you continue to do so.
Hello, and welcome back to Handmade, the making podcast with real talk about materials. I'm your host, material scientist Anna Pajewski, and this episode I talked to the brilliant Izzy Lawrence about craft in the suffragette movement. Izzy is an amazing stand-up comedian. We've done a few gigs together back when gigging together was a thing. And she's also an author of a children's historical fiction book, does history presenting work for the British Museum and Radio 4, and also produces a number of her own podcasts as well. In this conversation, we talk about the role of craft and making in the suffragette movement, since this was the world that Izzy wrote about in her book, which is called The Unstoppable Letty Peg. I started by asking Izzy if she writes historical fiction because she was once upon a time a history student herself.
No. Actually, weirdly, I have a science degree, but that science is geography. Shut up, it counts. So that is my background, isn't that? Though I've always read history and read around history. I've got an A-level in history and the rest of it, but I'm not strictly an historian. Nice. I am a fan of historians and what they say and what they find out. And I like to do my own primary research, go down the National Archives, get, you know, fingers a bit inky. And, that's good and fun. However, absolutely, completely winging it on this end of the podcast. So,
nice. Yay. Well, you're winging it extremely well so far.
Well, thank you very much.
So today we're going to be talking about, well, this is actually my own fault because normally every episode I name it a certain material, but actually I don't think we've really got a particular material in mind for this one. It's more a kind of making movement, I suppose.
Yeah. How do crafts feature in violent protest?
There you go. That's in this essay, I will.
Well, you know how needles hurt when you sew. That's nothing compared to policeman instruction. Yeah, so this book, what I wrote, is called The Unstoppable Letty Peg, and it's about a little girl set in 1910. Her dad is a policeman and her mum is a suffragette. So it's all about her being caught in the middle of the suffragette movement, having family on both sides and her stuck in the middle. And she learns jiu-jitsu with Edith Garrett, who trained the suffragette bodyguard. And she has lots of adventures, mainly involving a lot of horse poo. But there is some craft work in here. So she loves a bit of embroidery. Does Letty. She's a good embroiderist. And she also, I think her and Mabel make some they make some paper chains weirdly for Christmas. And also they make those little rosette badges at some point as well. So the craft is in her, but actually crafting as part of the suffragette movement was huge. Mainly because that was your basic skill set of the women there. So there's various ways that they sort of showed that you're a suffragette is to wear the colours. So you had the, you know, white for purity or something, purple for loyalty and green for burning down stuff. I can't remember. But yes, those are the signifying colours with the white, the green and the purple. And like Selfridges would sell them ribbons of these things and you go away and you'd add them to little bits and bobs. I think as well they used to carry around little boxes. There was a lot more carrying around of sort of knickknacks back in the day, and so you'd have these little, I think they were metal boxes that are heart-shaped, which would be painted to look suffragette-y. And of course, you know, later on there's some real skills going on, so you had not only beautiful embroidered flags, I don't think there were strictly any tapestries, but there were, you know, big banners that were being held up, women dressing in a sort of uniform. You also had, you also had like the jewellers as well. So there was actual suffragette jewellery being made, you know, properly. And also anybody who went to prison and stayed there a certain amount of time and protested and tried to become a political prisoner got a medal, which was all sort of made as well. So they left behind a lot of craft work and artistry and everything else. So it was a major part of their movement. And of course they used to do, you know, it sounds ridiculous, but it was a bit like the WI. They used to do bake sales. So they used to have these great, like huge exhibitions where they would open up Caxton Hall and that sort of thing and fill it with the public, and as well as their bake sales, it was an educational experience for people to come in. So they had like fake prison cells that you could go in and see what it was like being a suffragette. This is in 1909. This is what you did for a bit of fun, and you know, and the costumes as well. So they used to, like Edith Garrett herself, she was trained in jiu-jitsu, so she features heavily in my book, and she trained at the Golden Square Dojo in Soho, which was originally opened by Edward Barton Wright, who was your first mixed martial artist, really, because he combined shwingen and jiu-jitsu and savates and all of these different types of fighting. And he made his own gentleman's fighting called Bartitsu, which is named after himself, but he called it Bartitsu because that's the most serious thing. And right? He giggle, but a lot of people go, yeah, I know Bartitsu. Is that not real? Because they read it in Sherlock Holmes. Because, Arthur Conan Doyle wrote about it as a... Anyway, so that and the fairies. He was a great one for his research. But yeah, so Edith Garrod would, as part of her, you know, sort of... I don't know if she was a member of WSPU early on, but she did support them and help raise money for them. So she is a member of the Actresses Franchise League, who, you know, try to raise the esteem of women. So you had a load of performances, plays, songs, all of this, you know, up the women and all the rest of it. And she would perform in front of a room full of people, have a man attack her, usually dressed up as a police officer, and she'd throw him a poncinagi to the floor and beat his brains out, much to the surprise and delight of the crowds. She even wrote plays herself, which she then later performed. Naomi Paxton is the person you need to ask about all of this in detail, because she's written brilliant books about what the suffragettes all got up to. The stories that she can tell are absolutely incredible. However, that's what the suffragettes were doing. So it's this sort of great effort. And it was mainly to raise money. That was their issue. They needed money. And, you know, at the time, they were raising the WSPU, which is the Women's Social and Political Union, or as Letty Pegg calls them, WSPU. Well, WSPU were raising more money than the Labour Party. So this is a huge, you know, they're a huge political movement, and they were their own thing. They weren't the suffragists movement. The suffragist movement was even larger, but less bangy, fighty, Bernie Downey, smashy, smashy than the WSPU, which was started by Emmeline Pankhurst and had all the ladies in that you like Emily Davidson, who got run over by a horse. So all of
the
radicals are the ones that you see the most crafts and you see the most effort gone into, because they were radical in every way. And, you know, as well as doing the low craft art of women, they would go into places like the British Library and British Museum, which is the same building but shop, and the National Gallery, and smash stuff. So smash the high art and offer crumpets. That is what they were up to. So it was a really sort of interesting time, I suppose, to be, yeah. I don't know. Do you have any questions? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, loads of questions. I guess it's really interesting. So you said it was your book is set in 1910.
Yeah, 1910 to 1911. That is when I decided.
Is that kind of like the peak of the suffragette movement?
I'd say it gets really nasty in 1912. Because what was happening was you basically had this sort of general consensus that they probably should let women vote. And they sort of agreed on that in 1904. So by 1910, they'd spent the entire year waiting for Asquith to bring about this bill that would let them. The trouble with Asquith didn't have much of a majority, and he'd been trying to get a majority, but he'd only got a majority through a coalition with the Irish. And so he had Irish MPs who he didn't want to rely upon. So instead of, you know, this, I think they called it the Consolation Bill, which would allow women to vote along with a few extra men, they said, no, we're going to call another election. And that's the moment that my book starts, because there was a big event called Black Friday, where all the suffragettes, the WSPU specifically, marched on Parliament. And the Home Secretary at the time thought, oh, gosh, they're going to march on us. I tell you what, don't arrest them. If you arrest them, they're going to go to prison, they're going to protest, they'll be in the papers, it'll be terrible. Just stop them getting in Parliament, but don't arrest them. And the police went, you what? You know, they just don't stop if we ask them, right? And, you know, and Winston Churchill was like, I do not care. So the police and the suffragettes fought for about 10 hours. It was ridiculous.
Wow.
In the end, even though no arrests, please, I think 114 women were arrested that day and about five blokes. But the women were, you know, the police encouraged the crowds to, you know, assault them. And, you know, in my books for kids, I don't say what type of assault, but that type of assault too was happening.
Yeah.
Mrs. Billinghurst was, you know, chucked out of her tricycle, which was like a wheelchair at the time. You had women who suffered broken legs and who later died of, you know, some other women died of heart failure and that sort of thing a few days later. Jeez. So the stress of it was ridiculous. Mm. And it was a huge, massive event. And it made all the papers the next day, and it backfired on Winston Churchill, as it should do. However, so that's why I set it then. It's because it's just at the start of it. But later in 1912, what happened was the politicians were like, well, what's happening is the women are starving themselves in prison and we're force feeding them. And that's disgusting and unpopular. And they're still getting ill. So we're trying to stop them from dying and they're still getting really ill. In my book, that Christmas of 1910 is the first death from starvation, which is actually Emmeline Pankhurst's sister, who is Mrs. Clark. She was married, and so her name was Mrs. Clark, and she died over Christmas that year because she just, you know, I think she was arrested in the Battle of Downing Street, which was the protest to the previous protest, because it's so amazingly, you know, easy to remember all this, isn't it? But but she died, and so they had this problem of what do we do? And so what the government did was say, okay, look, if the women are going to starve themselves, fair enough. We'll release them the moment that they look like they're a bit peaky. They can get out of prison, go, and they can recover. But the moment they're recovered, we'll bring them back in prison. And then if they're still starving themselves, we'll keep them in a few days and then we'll let them recover and then we'll bring them back and we'll let them recover. And it was called colloquially the Cat and Mouse Act. It was like a cat playing with a mouse until it eventually died. It was just basically meant to exhaust them. And so they couldn't formally protest and do it properly. And that was nasty. And that's when you get to see the times where they're just like, right, arson, right, proper bombings this time. We're going to, you know, cut all the telephone lines and we're going to burn down shops and everything else. So it's quite a nasty time. But my book isn't set then, it's set slightly before then, so it's a bit cheerier for your kiddies. That is
nice.
When I say kiddies, I mean the thing is, because it's got jujitsu in it, and because I'm a fan of jujitsu and I do jujitsu, I do it so I know a lot of 50-year-old black belts who've been reading my book enjoying the violence that is in there, because it's accurate violence, which is quite nice. So the throw names are real, and the amount of horse poo there was is real. So it's not, it's a bit, it's aimed at the sort of Harry Potter age, you know, thing. So if you see a man, a grown-up adult, reading The Unstoppable Letty Peg, I think that's admirable, and I think he should. It's good for him. A bit of feminism.
Well, it's for the historical intellect.
Exactly. And the correct throws and knocks. So that,
So were the suffragettes, were these kind of working class women, or was it a range, or was it sort of the nobility?
Well, it's really weird. There is a mixture. So the point being is, it's mainly the people who front it and the people who are doing the letters and organising were all quite, you know, middle upper class women.
Yeah.
And they're fighting for the rights. We sort of say what they're fighting for at the moment in, like, you know, 1910, they're fighting for the right of women over 30 who are married, who own property, to vote.
Yeah.
Because at this time, not all men had the vote. This was a very specific class of women there. But at the same time, you had women like Annie Kenney, who was, you know, she lost a finger working in a factory in Manchester when she was nine. You know, so this is, you have working class women also doing it. The trouble is that, you know, the beauty of patriarchy is when you are a woman who is highly educated in order to get a good husband, and then you've got your husband and you've had your children, and then you're at your wit's end because there's only a certain amount of flower arranging for the church you can do before wanting to, you know, find something else in life, you know. So you either go hysterical and go absolutely barming mad, or you go barming mad and join the WSPU and start, you know, beating people up. So that is, you know, so the recruits were largely the people who could, which were generally women with the, you know, because if you're working, you know, if you're working in a jam factory in the south of London, you do not, you know, if you're lucky enough to have a husband who is coming home at night rather than spending all of his dot money down the pub, it's, you know, there's, it's a really hard, you know, you don't have any spare minutes. You know, housework at this point takes an enormous amount of your time. You don't have the time to do anything other than, you know, survive, really. So this is why you see it's a very sort of middle class women thing. And also the fact that they are not fighting for the right for working class women at this point.
Yes.
Yeah, I think in an ideal world, they'd like to see that. However, as it stands.
Priorities.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering then if the crafts that we see from the suffragettes tend to be those that are known to the middle and upper classes, as opposed to, you know, the skills that were needed, like you say, in the factories.
I mean, I would imagine so. I don't think, I mean, if you look at just the things they were using, so the fabrics, then these are not secondhand dresses that they're tarting up. These are, we've bought the fabric, thank you, for this purpose. And if you look at the jewellery, I mean, obviously, I'm not sure what working class women were doing at this time. I don't imagine you had much in the way of, you know, extra money to spend on your hobbies, particularly if you had children. You know, if your crafts would be remaking, resewing your children's clothes so they fit, you know, a bit later on, and saving up for basic household stuff. In this case, the women were making these crafts for the purpose of, one, spreading the message of the suffragettes, and also raising money for, you know, so they can, you know, have more political clout.
When you were doing the research for your book, did you come across any sort of interesting crafted objects that particularly caught your eye?
I'm trying to. I went to which museum was it? Well, there was a museum that was having a. I can't remember its name now. It wasn't the British Museum, so it wasn't the best.
You're contractually obliged to say
that. Museum of London, exactly. I think it's Museum of London or something like that. They had a big display of suffragette, you know, stuff. Which included all the, you know, jewellery with the, you know, elaborate, the green, the white and the purple jewels and that sort of thing, which is incredibly elaborate. They also had the medals. And I just remember the banners, because the banners are very, you know, they look like they're done by machine. And theoretically, they could have been done by machine, but they weren't. They were done very neat stitching by very sensible, very clever women. And they've done, you know, beautiful letters and that style, that sort of. I'm afraid you can see I'm not a very good, you know, typographer or you know, crafter myself, because I don't know any of the lingo. But there's a very Edwardian style. It's almost Art Nouveau, but not quite yet. Sort of that elaborate, flowy. What do they call it? I want to say house style, but that's not right. Anyway,
I don't know either.
I don't. Well, there's a certain type. I sort of vaguely know it's in architecture. And I don't know it's in, you know, like the sort of cottagey kind of. Anyway,
it's sort of the points, the fonts and the designs and stuff.
Very of their era, and they're very fashionable. And that's the nice thing. If you've got, unlike other movements, you've got a load of, you know, because you can't get a job as a graphic designer or as an artist, and you can't be taken seriously. You have this untapped body of skill and of professional understanding that's never been unleashed, and you give them a project and they go wild because, you know, when you've got women with purpose, and, you know, and I'm saying, like, you know, all of these were middle class housewives. No, a lot of them were middle class underlings. You know, they were like teenagers and just getting into it and going, right. And they've got the skill, they've got a passion, they've got a drive. And you can just see it in the way that they're designing things. And but it's not only the design, it's also things like it's the opportune moments for photography, it's the opportune moments for stage, you know. This performance, I think it was Sylvia Pankhurst, one of Emmeline Pankhurst's daughters, who is incredibly good at propaganda. I mean, she gives Goebbels a run for his money. You know, she's really good at knowing what will look good, what will get the attention, and making sure the photographers are there, just the organisation of it. I mean, and the organisation is crazy. So when they go on these big marches, they're different town to town. They each get, you know, they've got a little union in their own places and they've got a thing, right, we're going to march and this circuit around Hyde Park, etc. I think this happened in 1909, and we're going to go in this order. So that means ladies on the inside must walk slower than the ladies on the outside, but they must keep pace. So it's one step, two step, three steps, four steps. Nobody should be out of place. And it goes white, green, purple, not purple, white, green. That'd be ridiculous. And you've got to do it, you know, really like precise.
Yeah.
To the point where you're just like, oh my goodness, I couldn't be part of this. I'm far too much of a free spirit or lazy. But yeah.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So these were women that were making stuff that they needed for themselves. And I wonder if they turned to crafting and making precisely because they didn't, you know, they didn't have the means for ordering mass production and turning to the industry that was ruled by the men. Maybe the reason that they made the stuff themselves was because they didn't actually have the infrastructure available to them.
They were using, you know, because the whole point of doing the small crafts is that you make the money and you get the donations. And so you have national newspapers like the Suffragette, which is going out and vote for women. These are going out nationally as an official paper. So women are selling these on the streets and everything else. So this is, when I sort of say it's crafty, it's crafty in the sense that this is a banner that we're making for our particular, you know, suffragist or suffragette, you know, this is our banner for our little, you know, branch. That is all crafted and that is all elaborate. And you want to show how important your town is by putting all that effort in, really just to sort of show off to other women, look at what we can do. But on the other hand, you have, okay, let's make this professional. So Sylvia Pankhurst was a professional PR woman. I mean, she managed to get her stories in the papers that she needed to. She had the connections. She managed to start their own paper, which was funded, you know, largely, you know, obviously male funds as well, because men were involved in the suffragettes and suffragists. But they were printing this paper and they went to prison. So in 1912, there's a huge court case because it was seen as you're inciting violence. And by inciting violence, and they took them to court, and it cost them a fortune, and it split the whole SPU in half, and it was a big deal. But yeah, no, to pretend that this was all craft would be wrong, But I think it's certainly on an individual little branch level. If you've got a little branch somewhere and you're wanting to show up on a national stage, you know. I mean, the great crafts they were really doing was bombs. They were very good at making bombs. They really were. Their incendiary devices weren't as good. So they had very basic incendiary devices, which they're using to blow up police boxes. Not police boxes. I don't think they did any. It was mainly post boxes. So they would post a little bomb, which would go in a post box, and then you'd have a little incendiary device inside, which would burn it. But the basic one that we're using, I think, was potassium. So you get potassium. It was sulfur, wasn't it? Was it? Ah, see, this is where I'm forgetting stuff. But basically, it was a substance whereby once the gel it was in had evaporated off, it would set fire to itself because it reacts with oxygen in the air. And, of course, you know, some of these women weren't very good at preparing these, and others would get distracted and go to the shops first and that sort of thing. So you had a lot of arrests made by women who caught on fire on the way to the post box and were actually arrested in the doctor's office having their burns treated. Because you had women catching fire. Because they weren't particularly good at those, but their bombs are pretty good and they were quite good at, you know, they would write messages on, like, you know, the lawns and that sort of thing for Votes for Women and the rest of it, which is, I admit, not a very popular craft nowadays, but it is a unique bit of public statement art.
That's one way of putting it.
Yeah. But they were, I mean, all of that sort of stuff, these different ways of, because, you know, part of them, they didn't want to cause loss of life. They were quite good about that. This was mainly just to go, pay attention to us. And the way that they organised, I mean, the organisation is crazy. So when they did, like, window smashing, they would literally have, you know, hundreds of women, different parts of London, all at exactly, and it was never, like, on the exact o'clock. It was, you know, at 2 minutes to six, all taking out toffee hammers and smashing the nearest High Street window. But having that all planned and organised beforehand, so each woman knew where she had to be at that precise time, all smashing and all running from the police at once.
Jeez.
So, and these are private property, you know. There's wonderful ones. That court case in 1912 when they're doing, they've got all of their records come up. So all of their old notes and sort of correspondences are in the court documents. So you can actually read them. And there's one woman, this poor woman who had a stall in Hyde Park, not Hyde Park. What's that one that's south of Hyde Park by Marble Arch? But Green Park, isn't it?
Yes.
She had a stall there, and it was sort of, you know, it's like a tea stand. That was basically what it was. Suffragettes burnt it down as protest, and she wrote to them saying, "Listen, this is a female-owned business. I don't have the thing. I understand. I'm sympathetic with your cause, but can you, you know, this is really bad. Can I have some sort of apology? I'm going to rebuild, and if you could, you know, possibly give me money towards that." And she got a very curt letter sort of saying, "Well, I'm sorry, but this is part of the fight. And if you don't understand that, this is war." And then 2 weeks later, it's just like, "I rebuilt it and you burnt it down again." It's just like, really, like, wow. They're not sympathetic to anybody who doesn't, you know, who comes up even slightly against them in any way. So they were not, they're hard to like when you get to know the suffragettes a bit. But, the suffragists are lovely, but very ineffective. Well, we've been asking nicely for 65 years, and I'm sure there'll be something soon.
Just a matter of time.
Exactly. We'll just keep asking nicely.
I was going to bring this conversation around to talking about kind of craft in the modern day and feminism, but I realise we've just been talking about bombs, which is not so much part of the mainstream feminist movement anymore. But
should it be, though? This is the question.
That's the question that history asks us. And thinking about kind of what the suffragettes were doing and what that can tell us about the modern day. You know, craft is still a big part of feminist action. We saw the pussy hats at the women's march in 2017. I forget the name of the women that made the pattern, but it's basically like this like pink knitted or sewn hats.
One of them
that had
is in the British Museum collection, just so you know.
No way.
Yeah.
What, one of the originals?
Yeah.
Or just an example? Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. I think it was one of the originals, but I'm not 100%. Or from the original group, anyway. I don't know if it was one of the first to be made.
Okay. Yeah,
That's in the collection, along with all of the Nasty Women Make History ones.
Oh,
and,
yes. Yeah, yeah,
which,
yeah.
Which, you know, and all of that sort of stuff. It is all collected. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about the British Museum. I'm banging on about it because I do a podcast to them called the British Museum Membercast. But if you're interested. But one of the great things is that they collect modern stuff. So it's an ongoing collection. It's not just the old things. It is the, oh, this is interesting now. Let's do it. So they've got, like, credit cards. They've got a whole, you know, thing of mobile phone stuff with the boxes and the original packaging and everything else. And they also obviously collect all of these different protest and art as well. There was a South African art exhibition which, you know, had the, where the colour purple, because of South African protests using that, featured greatly. And it was amazing to see how different people's doing different protests sort of represent themselves through art and through craft mainly as a sort of big demonstration of going, this is us, and how big and fantastical you can make, you know, what you're doing. Well, they should have had a massive blow up suffragette, of course. That was rising above, going, way. That would have been.
Well, like a big inflatable one.
Yeah. But, you know, it would. It was all a bit sort of practical, unfortunately. So all the stuff, I don't know if it counts as craft, but all the sort of, like, you know, because you could, you know how, like, shops and stuff should, like, go, oh yeah, you know, the hashtag Me Too, you got, like, Topshop selling T-shirts with it and that sort of stuff.
Right.
But, you know, back in, you know, Selfridges, and I think Liberty as well, they'd have, like, you know, they sell the ribbons so you can make your stuff, but they also sell already made rosettes, and I think there was I think I mentioned the heart-shaped cases, didn't I? But I believe those things, even like suffragette toilet soap and, you know, really sort of, because this is just the time when materialism, you know, our capitalist, you know, shopping and, you know, thing was really getting going. So, you know, the first department stores, they cash in on it. So you could get like a lovely little belt with the ribbon, you know, the right colours and that sort of thing. Be really fashionable.
Interesting.
Yeah. But I think, I think what we can't, the big difference between then and now is now people make the banners, they go on the protests, and there's a sort of set idea of it. And there's this sort of thing of going, this is what we do because we're doing it for the protest. I do think that a lot of these women had to do something. Mm. And it's because when you're not, there is no career opportunity, there are no opportunities to do stuff, you will do what you do to the best of your ability. See, my grandmother, I could tell she's a housewife. She was a Renin during the war, and she was a housewife, and she helped run a charity for a time. She helped with that, but she obviously helped with that, and the men with her, and she helped very, very strongly. And you could just see that she was a natural business person, but she never got to do it. And she never got that sort of, and I don't think, you know, she, it wouldn't have occurred to her really. It was the 1950s, it was post-war, she had babies. But no, you know, this is the dream now. Be happy with it. Exactly. And you do get this. And she loved embroidery and she loved painting. She loved gardening and she, everything, all this energy put into this stuff. And it's great. And it's lovely to sort of, you know, inherited a few of her bits and bobs, but you're just there just going, imagine what you could have done if things had been different. Not if you're a man, but if things had been different and you had that, you know, and it's this sort of weird, you don't know whether to be, you know, I sort of see craft and I see, you know, these hobbies as, one, the fact that we call them craft and we call them hobbies and we don't take them seriously because it's girls. It's girls doing stuff, you know, it's very silly. But also it's, it sort of makes me sad because it sort of makes me see, wonder what these people could have done if they were given. But on the other hand, it might have all, you know, my granny, she might have, you know, I say this, she might have been a terribly awful politician and ruined the world. Who knows?
So, who knows? Equal opportunities
might have been saved. Might have been saved from her terrible leadership. But yeah, no, it is a weird sort of, you know, there's a great, I think when we look at crafts from the past, particularly crafts which men poo-poo and artsy is high art because they didn't have enough naked wobbly bits in them. And they're all sort of like made for children, which are beautiful, proper bits of art that if they were in a museum or up on a gallery wall, you'd go, wow. I mean, I'm thinking particularly, I mean, if you look at some of, I've seen some of those blankets that women make in America, those ones where those where they have the crochet, you know, the different squares and they've built this huge thing up and you're just there going, oh my goodness. And part of it makes me terribly sad because that's so much better than most of what Picasso does. Not that I'm picking on Picasso, but fuck Picasso. seriously. I mean, compare, you know, the creativity and stuff, it's all, it's, it belies this frustration of this is all I can do. It's very much, you know, I every time I'm sat in lockdown just going, oh, but I can't go out and I can't see my friends and I can't, that's no different to having a husband at war back in the past, you know. And you don't have the money to do anything and you're in charge of your own house and your daily routine is dull. Yeah. And there's nothing you can do about it and you're stuck here. So you make the best of it. So you draw your little pictures and you make little podcasts. Admittedly, you didn't do that in the past, but you know what I mean. And you and you try and get, you try and make the thing, the small little things, the best you can.
But that's so interesting because so many people in lockdown turned to crafts and channeled the excess energy. I think energy is a really interesting thing. And you said it earlier, like people channeling either angry energy if they don't have the vote and they want the vote, or channeling boredom in lockdown or anxiety in lockdown into making stuff because it just feels like the one thing that you can do. And at the end of knitting your pussy hat or at the end of appliquing your Votes for Women banner or whatever it is, at least you've achieved that. Even if tomorrow you don't have the vote, even if next year you don't, at least you've done something.
It's a way of making the intangible tangible. So it's a way of showing that your frustrations are real and having other people see them and acknowledge them and going, that was there, that happened. It's a big deal. But it also shows how deeply, you know, isolated you are in that little way. And this is a way of showing that we're all together and stuff. I mean, the beautiful thing about the pussy hat thing is it was such a sort of coming together and a big sort of like mass standing up and saying, we voted for what?
Yeah.
What? Why?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, yeah. And it felt, even though it might not have been, but it really did feel at the time that it was pure misogyny. That would allow that to happen.
But what a beautiful, peaceful protest.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the thing is, suffragettes will tell you, it does nothing. Peace does nothing.
Well, not on that day, maybe, but it does unite people.
It seems to.
And it spreads
a
message.
But then also, I mean, then you look at... what's it? We Are the 99%. Those movements, incredibly peaceful and just fractured under themselves so quickly because, you know, it's amazing how good movements just go, you know, they just don't accept that everybody can't be part of them. And that's sad.
Yeah, so true. But then, you know, the relics of these movements, if they don't achieve what they wanted to go out to achieve, the relics are what people have made to put towards them, which is interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, you have all this love and this care and this, you know, the fact that if you make something you love and care shows that you love and care about the thing it represents, which is a good thing. It's a good thing.
Definitely. I think that's a great place to end the podcast. So if people have enjoyed hearing about the suffragettes, where can they go to find out more about what we've been chatting about?
Well, if you go to izzy.com, that is isodi.com, you'll find more about me and my book, and you'll find links to my other podcasts, which includes the British Museum member cast, includes Terrible Lizards, which is about dinosaurs and nothing to do with crafts, unless you like cleaning fossils. Is that your craft?
That'll count, yeah.
Exactly. And you can find links to all my other little projects and everything else. If you want to find out a lot more about suffragettes, I really recommend checking out Naomi Paxton's work, because I think she's absolutely fantastic. Other than that, there's loads of amazing books, but I recommend starting with The Unstoppable Letty Peg because it's a bit of a laugh and it's a bit of an adventure. You don't have to think about the history, you can just enjoy the story.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Izzy. It's been great to chat to you.
Thank you.
So that was the awesome Izzy Lawrence. Thanks so much to her for taking the time to come and talk to me on the pod. Definitely check out all of her other projects. The book is called The Unstoppable Letty Peg and is available, you know, from just all the normal places that you can get books. And her website is izzy.com, I-S-Z-I.com. You can say hi to us on Twitter. We're at Real Talk. That's R-I-A-L Talk. And as always, you can follow us on Instagram at Handmade Pod. Thanks as always to Dave Shepherd for our marvellous cover art and to Alex Lathbridge for the fab music mix. That's everything for this episode. Next week, I'll be talking to archaeological conservator Angela Middleton about leather. So until then, take very good care and I'll look forward to speaking to you next time on Handmade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.